very extraordinary kind of moment going on in humanity. And I've been traveling around the world. We just completed a 37th trip around. And I'm not a tourist. This is purely incidental to the way life goes. And I certainly just beginning to feel our planet as really being a sphere. It's a very, very big sphere to you and I, but I'm beginning to really have some personal feeling of this as a home. People often ask me where I live, and I say I don't mean to be facetious or rude, but I live in a little planet called Earth, and that's what we really all do. But it's interesting now. I've gotten to a point where I can really feel it as comprehensible, and I've had it statistically shown and made many maps of the world and made drawings of the world time and again, but to actually begin to feel it pulsing together. And so I'm really confident that humanity is now going through a state of transition on our planet, absolutely unprecedented, and is not number one. We have very much knowledge we didn't have long, long ago. Human beings, having always been born naked, helpless, no experience, therefore absolutely ignorant, and humanity has had to find its way. And humans are really endowed with, first place, we're given hunger, so we'd be sure to take on fuel. And we're given thirst, so we carry on the chemical process and to breathe, that's all spontaneous. And we're given a reproductive urge to reproduce ourselves, so we finally get to wherever we're supposed to get in some kind of... We certainly, obviously, are here for something extremely important. The information that just said that is so, that we take the complexity of the chemistries of human beings and all the principles that they demonstrate, that we know in physics and chemistry, that there's nothing quite so complex we know of in all the universe, short of universe itself. We seem to be almost miniature universes. And yet, being given hunger and reproductive urge and being born ignorant, man also was given sort of a vanity and a way to kid himself along, to excuse himself from making mistakes. Really, mistakes, nothing could be more important. You have to find yourself by trial and error. But he's had a tendency to, I find, for instance, I personally have lived through very great change that was not anticipated by anybody when I was young. And as each stage occurs, everybody acts as if they knew that all the time. Right now, everybody knows anybody can go to the moon. That's a very easy thing to do. And humanity has then this strange way of immediately making themselves rather superior and retrospectively. Point is that I see these are characteristics, and I'm sure that they were put there in many ways, they would not really carry on if they might become much too discouraged if they didn't have this self deceit to some extent. And so I find humanity so rationalizing that it intends to think of itself as responsible for this whole universe. And it looks on the stars and everything, just sort of decoration, and the whole show is right here, and what you and I decide the way the next election goes is the way the whole universe is going to go. So I go through exercising myself very frequently, which I think about what we do know about the scale of things and the general information, where we find our little planet is 8,000 miles in diameter, the highest mountains 5 miles above sea level, the deepest water 5 miles below that, 10 miles differential between the outermost points and the innermost points, and 10 miles in relation to 8,000 1/800. If you make a sphere, or maybe a big 6-foot sphere, if it polished steel, it'd probably be rougher than is our actual Earth. So when we have photographs being made of coming in to the earth now through the cloud cover. You can't make out there's a blue of water and there's a brown land. There's no slight suggestion of any altitude or any depth. And you and I, human beings, average about between birth and their total life, take all humans and average out the children, all about 5 feet, about 5,000 feet to a mile. So it takes 1,000 of us laid end to end to make a mile. So it would take 10,000 of us to make the difference between the outermost points and the innermost points. So the fact that that's invisible, you and I are about 1/10,000 of invisible on that planet. And that planet is a very small planet, as the planets of the sun. And the sun itself is a rather inferior star. If you look at Orion's belt, which is very, very familiar to most people in the sky, there's a brightest star, there's Betelgeuse. And Betelgeuse's diameter is greater than the orbit of the Earth around the sun. That's a good-sized star. So we have this inferior star, and it's one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy. And human beings, endowed with the capability to discover principles and to develop refraction of light and to make lenses and so forth, we now have developed telescopes and taken photographs of 1 billion such galaxies. We now know of 1 billion galaxies of approximately 100 billion stars each. Now, in that kind of this observation is omnidirectional. Out of all those stars, 99.99% are invisible to the naked eye. But we've been able to increase our information, get to have it there, so that we multiply a billion times 100 billion, which would be the number of stars we now know about, and try and make 1 billion times 100 billion points around us as a sphere, for instance. You find that it really be like having a steel shell and have all the atoms in a steel shell around us would be something like that, the relative plenitude of those stars. I'm thinking about some such big, enormous shell sphere and trying to find a point somewhere near a sun and trying to find even a planet Earth somewhere, and that would be absolutely impossible. Our magnitude, to try to find you and I, incredible. I'm quite confident that show is not depending on whether the conservatives or Labour comes in or whether it's Republicans or Democrats. I'm sure that universe is absolutely indifferent. That this couldn't be more nonsense. We really are playing some games on board of our planet that have nothing to do with the really great big show. So I've been terribly excited through my life to try to find, if I could, any of the clues of what the bigger show might be, how we happen to be here. One of the things that you and I can observe out of the total data so far is that amongst all the living organisms, biological organisms, human beings are not only about halfway between the biggest and the smallest, but they have something that distinguishes them from all the other species, as all the other species have some integral equipment built in, as wings or something, special feelers, designed for special environments. And so if the bird gets on beautifully in the air, flying, but when it's not flying, it cannot divest itself of its special equipment, and is hampered very greatly by it. So whether it's in a special kind of a plant that grows, as we know, just in a special kind of an area, this is all typical. But human beings have, not uniquely, because there are many creatures that have brains, we simply have a little more storage for special case information. And then what human beings have over and above this brain, the brain is always correlating the smellings, the seeings, the hearings, all the sensings. And also it can store it, and it has after image, it can recall, pull, bring back again. And then human beings have the phenomena of mind, and I find mind and brain often used seemingly interchangeably, but I find necessity for the word mind, because there's something goes on with the human beings, not in the brain. As I said, the brain is always and only dealing with these special case information. Because from time to time, mind discovers a relationship between special case information that's not in the special case information by itself. It's only by a great complex. For instance, long ago, historically, we have humans making it clear that they are aware of 5 quite bright stars, unusually bright, that seem to move differently. The rest of the stars seem to be all in one position. They move around the universe together. But there was five in addition lights in the sky other than the sun and the moon that seemed to move around, that were, but they didn't move around in any correlated kind of way that you and I could know about. They're just simply different positions. So gradually, the fact that there were five bright lights doing something different made human beings intuitively say, "I want to," because they're different. They may have some relationship to one another. Gradually, human beings did make observations and did chart quite a lot about the planets. They got quite a lot of data back in Greece and Mesopotamia, Egypt. Then, it's not until man develops the capability to calculate, and Roman numerals were operative up to 1200 A.D., which is a very short time ago. There are many things on the U.K. that are 1200 ago, no time at all ago. Man began to be able to do a loop. Not until 1500 does he actually get out in the public domain how to do things, positioning of numbers to multiply. If you ever try to multiply or divide with Roman numerals, you find out you would have, no matter how excited you might be about things you observe around you, if you try to make some calculations, you have no way to calculate. So 1500 is when the what we call positioning of numbers, or when I first went to school, when I went downtown, the butcher said, "Have you learned to do your ciphers yet?" Ciphers was a clue. Ciphers made you position your numbers. And Copernicus comes in just when man has that first chance to really do some calculating. And with his calculating capability, he began to calculate that our position of observation might be a planet also. And then he stimulated Tycho Brahe, who was a man of wealth, to invest his wealth in a great many instruments to observe. And Kepler did most of the observing and did really amass some very extraordinary new data. I'd just like to think about, in relation to things I've been talking about, this betweenness that's not of, as far as discovering relationship go. Kepler then had all the very accurate data on the orbits, found they were moving in ellipses, and if you and I ever make an ellipse instead of a circle, we know that we have to have two restraints. And he found then they were moving in ellipses, and he found then he had all the data on what the length of time of the orbits of each one of them, what the sizes were, how far out they were from the sun at any given time. But all of them were different. They were different sizes, different distances, going around the sun at different rates. But one thing in common was they're going around the sun. And so they apparently were a team, but it was very disconcerting that there was such disorder. This team, first place, is a very amazing thing that they, in the enormous distances they were apart, that they could be doing anything as a team. You don't know why. So Kepler then, with mathematical capability, which means you really can make some mathematical hypothesis, he said, "I've got to find something that's common to all of them, because I can't. There's nothing in their dimensions or their distances or their times of orbit that is common." So he gave them a very small amount of time, which would be common to all of them. He gave them all 2 weeks. I think that was a period of maybe 3. That's irrelevant for the moment. He gave them a very short amount of time. And because he knew how far each one was from the sun, in giving him 2 weeks, he knew exactly how much arc each one would describe in 2 weeks. So he made then a line, theoretical line, from the sun to where it started, and then 2 weeks later, that's the end of the arc, and came back to the sun again, making a piece of pie shape. So within the same 2 weeks, he then had the shapes of the dimensions of these pieces of pie described by each one. Some were long and thin, and some were short and fat. But because he had this data now, he was able then to calculate the area. And this sort of strange thing, actually calculate the area of nothingness, really, of space, but he calculated the areas of those pieces of pie, and he found within that given amount of time, they're all exactly the same. Supposing you were the first human being to do that, having seen a superficial disorder, but suddenly an incredibly elegant mathematical agreement hidden away there. That there's something correlating there between relative distance away and the rate of going around that all come out the same. So then he said, I could understand this if they were gears and touching each other. We can understand how, but being fantastic distant apart, how can they possibly develop this extraordinary correlated action? And so he said, well, one thing about it, I do see then, if I swing a weight around my head, it goes in orbit. If I let go, it goes off in a line. So apparently, it's some kind of a tensive restraint, because there's no compressive restraint that you'd have with gears. But somehow or other, over incredible distances of the heavens, these tensive effect, there's a tensive effectiveness. We come on to Galileo, also now with mathematical calculating capability, 1500, making measurements on rates of bodies going down inclined planes at various angles and free falling. Galileo discovering this free falling rate, the rate was always accelerating, and the rate it was accelerating was actually multiplying the number times itself, what we'd call second power. And then we have Isaac Newton, very excited by all these people, and wonder if he could not somehow or other identify something more about that tensive relationship that Kepler had identified. Then, so Isaac Newton also using mathematical freedom to hypothesize something. He said, I see then if I do have a weight on a string, like Kepler, and I let go, it goes off on a line. So he formulated his first law of motion by saying a body would persist in a straight line except as affected by other bodies. So when he sent this off like this, and he found the Earth immediately began to pull on it. If he did a little harder, went just a little further, then got pulled over 90 degrees. So he said, obviously, whatever that pull thing is, the Earth has a very much more powerful effectiveness than I have in sending it out that way. Then also, considering the information man had at that time regarding moon and Earth, and knowing that you had the moon phases and the tides are clearly identified, that quite clearly the moon was pulling the waters of the Earth trillions of tons daily. The pull must be fantastically great between these two bodies, which was so much bigger than Newton himself. So he said, I think that the inner attraction has something to do with their sizes. And I can understand then why then the pull of these two big bodies, the Earth's such a big pull, that two apples are too small, their pull towards each other is so meager that the pull of the Earth overcomes its sense of friction and would not allow them to come together. So you and I have not tended to be confronted with the bodies are pulling each other, but it's then maybe proportional to mass. That's a very good guessing job in his part. So then he then said, supposing, these are not his words, but this is the concept. Supposing the Earth suddenly stops pulling on the moon, that is, the Earth is annihilated, then it would go off in this line, this way, a weight that you're swinging around your head, you stop pulling it, go off this way. Then it would gradually be affected by other celestial bodies. So Isaac Newton then, because astronomers by this time had good plotting for any given moment of any evening of where the various constellations would be. This has been well observed. The navigators were using this data very well. He then was able to figure where the moon would be on a given night at a given time, where it would be positioned against other constellations. And so then on that night, he assumed that the Earth would then, at that moment, release the... So he then quite easily mathematically developed the line at which it would go off if the Earth suddenly released it. That was easy to plot. So then on that night, at that moment, he measured the rate the moon was falling away from the theoretical line towards the Earth. He found that it was falling towards the Earth at exactly the same rate as Galileo's accelerating second power pull of the falling bodies. This then gave him a clue about the second power. So then he formulated the idea that first you have then the relative interattractiveness as against two apples or whatever it might be was due to the masses. But then if you halve the distance between the two, quite clearly, because of the second power, you halve the distance and the interattractiveness would be fourfold. Or if you double the distance apart, then the interattractiveness would be reduced to one quarter what it was. So he spoke about it as the inverse ratio of the second power. At that time, the literacy of humanity was so low, I'm sure very few humans heard that Newton had said what he said. The astronomers and many astronomers paid great attention. So he began to apply his hypothetical law to celestial phenomena in general. And surely enough, it explained every bit of it. He didn't know that we were going to, he did not know we were going to get into microcosm as we have today. He did not know that, and that when we came to where there's no electromagnetics in the atomic world, that mass attractions are operative, follow his exact laws. So that this has turned out to be an absolutely reliable behavioral law. So now I'm coming back to brain then, taking in special data, recording it and so forth, but mind very apparently spurred on by intuition that something's going on here that's worth pursuing, that really inspiring human beings to spend their whole lives at such work as Kepler did. There, you suddenly discover a relationship existing between. There was nothing in the geometry, the geometrical dimensions of our Earth or geometrical dimensions of the Moon. There was nothing in the chemistry of either or anything in the electromagnetics of them that said, observing one by itself, that's going to attract another body. Absolutely nothing. Suddenly, there was nothing in any one of those bodies said, if you have the distance, the inner attraction is going to increase at fourfold or a second power exponentially. But I'm really trying to get out. I don't think anything more important for me to catch on to or you to catch on to. We really want to understand a little about what human beings do have that is unique in the universe, which is this mind, is this ability to discover relationships existing between that are not ours. Any of the special case data. So, and brains are always dealing just that special case data. That's why I realized that I have to identify, so the word mind is the most convenient word I can find, to have this capability to discover relationships existing between. If you ask Mr. Newton then what this gravity is, you say, obviously I can't tell you because there's no quality or characteristic of any of the parts you can point to. All we know is a relationship existing. In other words, when you get to the beginnings of great science, the experimental undertaking, you discover an a priori absolute mystery, within which a priori absolute mystery, a lucidly behaving regularity occurs, an incredible, lovely thing. These are, we have the word synergy, or the behavior of whole systems unpredicted by the behavior of any of the parts considered only separately. So we find all the great scientific discoveries are exactly that. They are discovering the behavior between that is not ours in any way indicated is going to happen by any of the parts themselves. So all the great scientific discoveries are synergetic. And in fact, I found that, I don't know how many of you know me and met with me in years gone by, but I have now visited over 500 universities and colleges around the world. And for the first 300 of such visits, I would ask the audience, anybody familiar with the word synergy, please raise their hand. And I would have somebody stand up in front of me, help me count, get a little idea of the percentage. The university audiences around the world average 3%, and public ones less than 1%. So that I could see quite clearly the word was not popular. And inasmuch as the word is the only word that means behavior of whole systems unpredicted by the behavior of the parts, synergy is the only word that means that, quite clearly society was not thinking there are such behaviors. Or they would have really wanted the word. The fact that it was not a popular word meant it was not in the general rationalizing and logic. I saw human beings then were quite content to just know about parts. They're content to be taken to school and say, now, darling, I'm going to give you an A and B and C, and just to work on parts, putting things together. The idea that they build up a body of knowledge would be that the whole sum total, that's all there was to it. And this is quite contrary then to the... To me, it's very, very exciting. I find myself really pulling a curtain apart to understand a little of what really has gone on historically, of the gradual trial and error gains of naked, helpless, ignorant man finally discovering such a phenomenon, that he's endowed also with the intuition that somehow or rather titivates him that something's going on around him and I better pursue it. Sometimes pursued for centuries, millenniums before he really finds out. Now, the fact then that human beings have this capability and the relationships they find can only be expressed mathematically. They have no physical reality. They are something like second power, multiplying the mass of time cells in second power in the relationship of gain. They're all of them mathematically statable. These are really then called scientific generalizations. And let's say you've discovered the principle of the lever. This is a very extraordinary matter for a man to discover. With our muscles to lift things up, that he discovers that with a lever you can lift, a little human being can lift maybe 20 times his own weight. Fantastic manner. So he's able to operate and alter his environment in favorable ways for survival. Well, you get the mathematics of that leverage is a very beautiful thing, just going out the distance from the fulcrum to the load, and go out one equal increments just in balance, and call it a balance scale. Go out two increments, you have exactly, you lift 2 to 1, so forth. Beautiful arithmetical rate of gain. However, having been able to generalize that, that's a mathematical statable, and only mathematical statable, and say, I'm going to design a generalized lever. So you can't design a generalized lever. It has to be a wood or a steel, or it has to be such and such a length. I find that man then lives with his brain subjectively and always in special cases, and though he can discover the generalized principle and can use it, he can only employ it in another special case. And all the special cases are terminal. They're all to do with an entropic world of systems that are coming apart gradually. Everything is terminal. Whereas the principles themselves I talk about, generalized principles, in order to be able to qualify as generalized principle, there can be no exception. But you and I, because we operate so prominently with the brain, and the brain deals always with terminals, tend to want to have things begin and end. We want to explain how the universe began and when it's going to end, or have that kind of... that's a brain way of looking at things. But the principles I speak about, you cannot be a principle and not be eternal. We don't tend to use that word eternal because the brain makes us think about terminal things. But the point is, to qualify, there must be absolutely no exception, which means inherently eternal. So we find humans then gradually, accidentally, intuitively, pulling curtain aside, we're beginning to learn a little about some of these qualities of eternity, some laws of eternity, which no other creature, we don't know any other phenomena in the universe that has the capability. So we do know many with brains, we know many that can fly very beautifully, whatever it may be. But this is what we really have. And by virtue then of this ability to discover principles, human beings then Bernoulli discovers the principle of pressure differentials, and we develop a wing foil and the negative pressure, and man can make his own wing, fly now 50 times faster than any bird, take off his wings when he's not using it, give them to the next generation, give them to somebody else. The complete interchangeability, but the point is, deals in principles. Now, I find that human beings then are... They have this largest information gathering special capability of the brain, special case experiences, but they have this ability to discover principles, and that really differentiates from any other phenomenon we know of. Now, that we have this then makes me immediately think we must have some significance. We must be in here for some very special reason. When you and I talk about design in contradistinction to randomness or disorder, we mean that the parts are arranged somehow in relation to other parts. That's what we mean by design. A deliberate arrangement of parts, that's a design. So I'd say then, one of the most extraordinary things we find out about these generalized principles so far, if we begin to take inventory of how many we have found and we know anything about, is that none of them ever contradict any others. Being eternal, they're eternally, concurrently operative, and all of them interaccommodating.